Hey, friend, two quick notes. Maybe you're a brand new listener or you're a regular listener and you just had no idea. I want to let you know about two things. The London Lyceum has an awesome, vibrant online community, and it's open to anyone. If you'd like to join and participate in those discussions and to be active on that, we talk about all sorts of things. We have channels related to everything that we talk about here at the London Lyceum and more. Go to our website, go to the contact page, and just drop us a note, and we'll get you added to it. So if you're interested, go find that, jump on there. A second thing is we also have an exclusive content option for you podcast junkies that gives you a ton of benefits more than just extra podcasts. So just $5 a month, and it's to become a subscriber. You can find that on our resources tab under the podcast. It'll take you right there. It's going to give you a bunch of access to things like the additional bonus episodes that we do here, as well as a free digital version of the Hanover Review every issue that comes out, as well as free access to our reading groups and a lot more. So go check that out. I encourage you to do that. That helps support us to create more resources that directly benefits you. So you're feeding right back in to your own benefit for those sort of things. So we really appreciate your support. Do check those two things out, and I look forward to talking with you soon. On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Tim Cooper about the infamous Richard Baxter. So we cover all sorts of topics like who is Baxter and what can we learn from relationships he had with those like John Owen? What sort of lessons can we learn from this fractured relationship? What's Baxter's view of justification? Does this cause him to be unfairly represented, to have a poor reputation? What's Baxter's advice for dealing with grief, suffering, and death? What was Baxter's view of pastoral ministry, and is his model actually sustainable for ministers today? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and I'm joined by Garrett Walden. And we are a podcast that hopes to inspire and encourage serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've tried to cultivate or encourage also an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think it's good to know what we believe and to confess it happily. We also think it's good to learn from other people who have differing viewpoints and to learn about all sorts of things, because there's opportunities to make friends, find blind spots, and to become just better Christians. So part of the journey of the podcast is just talking to lots of cool people and learning about their subjects of expertise, the things that they've been dedicating their lives to. And it's a lot of fun. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Tim Cooper about Richard Baxter. And so depending on who's listening, Richard Baxter might be a hero or he might be a villain. So I guess we'll find out what we should think as we talk to Tim about Richard Baxter. So before we jump into anything, Tim, give me a little bit of background, who you are, where you're at, and then what was it that caught your eye initially with Baxter to say, I want to write a bunch of books on Baxter?
Hello, Jordan. Thank you for that welcome. Lovely to be a part of your podcast and to talk about Richard Baxter, to talk about myself. Just briefly, I live in a place called Dunedin, which is at the south of the South Island of New Zealand. I teach at the University of Otago. I teach the history of Christianity. I've been doing that for 19 years. In my personal life, I'm married to Kate. We have four boys, and now we have two grandchildren, one born just recently, which is delightful, of course. I'm part of a Baptist church. I used to be on the leadership team. I continue to preach on a regular basis, and that's me here in New Zealand. How did I come across Richard Baxter? I have to say that the Puritans are an unknown commodity in New Zealand for the most part. So I can't say that I even knew much about him when I began my PhD in the mid-90s, but he was the suggestion of my supervisor. Baxter's been a great choice for reasons that I hope to convey in the next few minutes, why he's just so interesting and so compelling. But I can't take credit for that choice. It was a suggestion of my supervisor, and I'm so grateful for it. It's just enriched my life in all sorts of ways.
Excellent. So maybe we just start with like that basic high-level bio. If someone has no idea who Richard Baxter is or just has a very cursory level of understanding of who he is. So think somebody like me who knows the Reformed pastor, and that's about it. when it comes to Baxter, but I know he's an influential figure. So I want to know more about him. Who is he? Why is he important? Those sort of things.
Well, I'm impressed that you can connect him to the Reform pastor, Jordan. That's a good start. Let me start really high level. Richard Baxter was born in 1615. He died at the age of 76 in 1691. First of all, he was a pastor. For a good 15 or so years, he was a very effective pastor in a town called Kidderminster in the Midlands, in England, but not far from the Welsh border. He basically reformed the town. I mean, if you want to see Reformation in action, he pulled it off in Kidderminster. So above all, I think first and foremost, he's a pastor. Whether he's working with real live parishioners or through his books, he's very, very often in pastoral mode. He was a prolific author. He wrote over the course of his life 140 books, some of them extremely long. One of the things that is so helpful to me as a historian about Baxter is that he never shut up. He never stopped writing. He always had something to say. And so there's this amazing, he's probably the most prolific writer in 17th century England. He wrote an enormous amount. So he's important as an author throughout the course of his life. Through his pastoral ministry in the Reformation at Kidderminster and through those publications, he gained widespread appreciation and notoriety. And that led to a kind of national reputation. And increasingly through the 1650s, he became a prominent voice in some national affairs. And if you know your 17th century English history, and you may not, there was a civil war, there was a republic, Oliver Cromwell, and then there was the restoration of the monarchy. Well, Baxter was a leading player in the negotiations for a new religious settlement for England at the time of the restoration. He then went on to be a nonconformist, so he couldn't conform to the terms of the Church of England at the restoration. Basically, he and many others like him were booted out of the church. And his pastoral ministry was very, very limited. He spent two periods in prison for his pastoral ministry, but he continued to write, continued to publish books, as I say, died in 1691. So a very important religious leader in England in his day.
That's amazing. Yeah, several things about Baxter there sounds a little bit like Jordan Stefaniak. And so... I do want to ask.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in prison, apparently.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, Jordan, and you know it. You have a book coming out soon on Richard Baxter and John Owen. And
yeah,
I would imagine a lot of our listeners are very familiar with John Owen. And I'll just speak for myself. I really like John Owen a lot, and I identify a lot with Owen in my own theological convictions. I know that Owen and Baxter didn't always see eye to eye. You've got a book coming out on this subject. Could you kind of summarize some of the maybe conflict? Mm. Were they ever friends? Could they ever be friends? Is it all conflict?
Oh, how much time have you got, Garrett? Listen, Becca, let me tell you the brief story of this book. In 2011, I published a big academic book that looked at the relationship between John Owen and Baxter. And what it did was to just excavate the different layers of their mutual dislike. And it was such an interesting story. If I could say this just generally, the kind of history that I'm really interested in is all about people and their personality and the effect of mundane factors like geography, basic things that these, you know, we tend to rarefy and purify these great thinkers, especially John Owen, so prone to that. But when you see their personalities, it's just fascinating. So listen, this was a personality clash that was just waiting to happen. For reasons that were set before they even met, they were never going to mesh easily, never. It was always going to be hard work. If they had met in the very best of circumstances, things might have gone better, but they didn't. They met in the very worst of circumstances that just precisely put the finger on their differences, that just went very, very badly. So there was that book in 2011. But of course, that's an academic book. It's long. It's expensive. But here was this really interesting story about two Christian leaders who just didn't get on. And that mattered. I mean, it mattered for the Puritan movement that they didn't get on. And I thought that was just a classic case study of what is a common experience throughout church history of Christians not getting along. And we live in an age where Christians, well, don't get along. I mean, it's part of the polarization and mutual incomprehension that we seem to experience at the moment, triggered a lot by social media. And so I just felt this would be a helpful story for us to understand what's really going on when a relationship breaks down. Because the confronting issues are often theological, but actually when you get down beneath that, there are other important factors that are at work. And if we can look at this story from, you know, a good 400 years ago and learn what goes on when a relationship breaks down, and then come back to our own time and our own place and ourselves, we might then be able to see ourselves a bit more objectively and think, oh, okay, I'm in this controversy, I'm in this dispute, or I'm observing this dispute around me, but let's think about what's really happening and the other factors that are in play. That, I think, is the value of that story. So coming back to Baxter and Owen, yes, they had their theological differences, and we could talk about those, but boy, they were two personalities that were never going to mesh, and they had very different experiences of the English Civil War, and they just had competing fears and agendas for what was going on around them, and that just made it difficult to get on, really difficult.
So I want to get the expensive book, and I looked at it, and I was like, $180 American dollars. I'm like, is there a paperback version or something?
Well, it's coming your way, Jordan. Yeah.
The paperback. So I can't, like, I'd love to know more just about the sort of the story between, like, the personality clash here. So, like, what is it that's driving, like, is it that, like, I don't understand the personality types. Like, I know from what I understand of Owen and what I've read of Crawford Gribbin's work on Owen, it seems that Owen was almost like a little bit depressed sometimes.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Is that playing into it?
Yeah. Look, it's so interesting. You see, I told you that Baxter never shut up. So it's very easy to get at Baxter's personality. It's all over the place. Owen, complete opposite. Told us nothing about himself. Honestly, all of those volumes of Owen's work that you might have on your bookshelf, he tells us one thing about his immediate family, about his father. One thing. All of his children predeceased him. Does he mention? No. Like, he gives nothing away. There's a humility to that. He just doesn't think the world is interested in him, right? And he's dismayed at Baxter, who's just embarrassing in what he's prepared to tell the world. It's an example of how they were so very, very different. But to get at their personalities, just briefly, Owen was someone who did not take kindly to being contradicted. And in this book, I give several instances where that pattern plays out. He does, whatever you do, don't contradict him. Baxter, in his own words, was inclined to blab out the truth as he saw it, and regardless of the impact on the other person. So Owen is a really classy politician. Baxter has no political felicity at all. This is what is so, I find so human and endearing about him, is that he was so deeply concerned for peace and bringing Christians together. And he wanted that right down to the very depths of his being. But his personality kept getting in the way, and he kept offending people and putting people off. So you've got Owen, who is easily exasperated, and you've got Baxter, who's just exasperating. Put them together in a context where they were meeting with a few others in a small room over an important issue and having completely polar opposite views, and that's a disaster waiting to happen, and it was a disaster. So it definitely comes down to personality, despite so much that they had in common. I mean, that's the really interesting thing. They had so much in common, but it was nearly impossible for them to see the commonalities. All that they could see and were confronted with were their differences, and that just drove them apart.
You know, you mentioned the differing experiences of the English Civil Wars, and I'd love for you to tease that out a little bit. But you know, as I think about it, I can't help but think of our own context and the division that seems to be amongst quite a few Christians, especially on political ends, of just experiencing what's been happening over the last several decades. And it seems to me like it's not the same events, but they're similar sort of fault lines where there's, in my head at least, where you're creating division based on just different experiences. So I'd love to hear some about that.
So let me start just briefly with the Civil War. It broke out in 1642. The first round of fighting lasted for 4 years through to 1646. And the Civil War went all over England. Hardly anywhere was untouched by it. It was an absolute disaster. It was a calamity for everyone involved. Now, both Owen and Baxter supported the cause of Parliament against King Charles I, right? So Owen and Baxter are on the same side, but their experiences of the war could not be more different. I'm going to argue that Baxter was traumatized by the war and never quite recovered. And the trauma is that he was displaced from ministry. He'd just begun at Kidderminster, but Kidderminster was in royalist territory, so he had to leave. He was threatened with clubs by a mob that tried to kill him. That's what he tells us. He then spends 2 years in a place called Coventry, hiding out, lying low, preaching to the army. And then he becomes an army chaplain because he's worried about bad doctrine circulating in the army. He follows the army around for the last couple of years or so as it's winning the final battles of the war, mopping up the final sieges. He sees a lot of death. He was there to see the Battle of Edge Hill, the first battle of the war, 1,000 dead bodies on the field the following day. He came out of that having seen, in his view, the gospel corrupted. The gospel had been corrupted by antinomian doctrine, he felt, that argued that we can just do what we want. God doesn't see sin in us as his children. And, you know, there is no law. Antinomian means against the law, right? So he's passed through this period of breakdown in law and order, if we put it in those terms. And in the end, his health collapses and he nearly dies in 1647. So that's Baxter's experience of the war. Now, there was one area of the country that was basically unscathed. Out of the hundreds of skirmishes and battles and events, only one took place in the southeast of England, to the southeast of London, and in Essex, and that's where Owen lived. So Owen goes through the war unscathed, unconfronted by the reality. And what he sees is the overthrow of Arminian doctrine. So if you know anything about Owen, you probably know that he's a Calvinist. He's not an Arminian. His first book was an attack on the Arminians, and they had been in a place of privilege, and it's one of the issues that led to the tensions in the war itself. So, for Owen, he felt the gospel had been rescued by the Civil War, and Baxter felt that the gospel had been corrupted by the Civil War, and there's just leads to this mutual incomprehension. And I wonder if that's the area of commonality, that We exist in tribes or communities where we just cannot comprehend the worldview of the other person, the other tribe. We just can't get into that frame of reference. And I think that's what it was like for Owen and Baxter, just from their different. I mean, it's just geography. It's just an accident of geography at that level. If Owen had been in Kidderminster, and Baxter had been in Essex, I'd be telling a completely different story. So it's how those sort of contingent, arbitrary factors play a part in a controversy without us even recognizing that that's what they're doing. We don't see it because we're confronted by the immediate issues, but actually dig deeper and there's a whole different frame of reference that we're acting within. And it would be good to recognize that and in a calm, considered way, try and understand each other at that level and just see if we can help the other person make sense to us, because that's just difficult.
Yeah, that's a great point. Those historical contexts really do matter, even the geography. I've got a question for you that I've wondered for quite some time. I'm sure you're aware of kind of, well, I guess, what was a debate. Now I think it might be settled, of the Calvin versus the Calvinists. And I wonder if there's something similar that happens with Baxter and the Baxterians. Are the Baxterians reflective of Baxter's theology? So just for example, in particular history, there's a fellow named John Bryan who in 1746, he puts Baxterianism in a list of kind of concerning doctrines. Yep. He has a dialogue between a Calvinist, a Socinian, an Arminian, a Baxterian, and a deist. So in that lineup, that's where it ranks. It ranks with Socinianism and deism. And is Baxterianism really reflective of Baxter? Yeah. And maybe a similar question is Baxter's relationship to Neonomianism. Is he a Neonomian?
Oh yeah, great. Look, Garrett, that's a fantastic question. I'm gonna try and answer it without getting bogged down in a whole lot of complexity, because those labels, you know, labels, we give labels to kind of simplify a great deal of complexity. So I'm going to try and not drown us in that. Let me start with Baxter himself. I'm going to say that Baxter was a Calvinist, but he was an unreliable Calvinist. His first book was called The Aphorisms of Justification. An aphorism is a pithy statement, right? And there's nothing pithy about Baxter's writing ever. But, oh no, he's a great writer. He is quite pithy, but he's never short. That's my point. The first 10 pages of that book are just classic Calvinism. They're great. There are the elect. God has promised infallibly to save them, and he will save them. I mean, it's brilliant. The heart of any Calvinist would be warmed by those first 10 pages and troubled by the remaining 300 pages, where what Baxter goes on to do is to put a hedge around that doctrine so that you and I are very clear that that doesn't mean we can do what we like. We have a part to play in this. At one point, he uses the image of a peppercorn. Right? It's just a peppercorn. It's just nothing. Actually, it's not nothing from a Calvinist point of view, because what he's saying is that salvation is realized not from God's election or before we were born or from the cross or from eternity. Salvation is realized only after a lifetime of perseverance and after we're dead. Right? So now it so happens that the elect will be those who persevere lifelong. Right, that's okay, that'll match up. But we've still got to persevere. There's a duty for us to repent. There's a righteousness that we need to bring. So he distinguished between legal righteousness, the righteousness of the law, that's what Christ gives to us. But there's an evangelical righteousness, a gospel righteousness that we have to deliver on. That includes perseverance and repentance, right? Now, suddenly, that's not sounding like a peppercorn anymore, right? That's quite significant. Now, what I think he's doing, because this is the system that he laid out in the aphorisms, is highly idiosyncratic. I mean, it was another word for it from the time, from a critic, is hodgepodge divinity. That's about right. No one ever followed it. Like, no one really liked it. Baxter loved it. Never departed from it. But what he's trying to do is, remember, in the Civil War, he himself was strongly Calvinist. In fact, he would say he was within the boundaries of antinomianism. Then he observed his friends in the army who were taking that doctrine and applying it in ways that he found deeply troubling and alarming. And finally came to see that his own theology was the problem, and he needed a new theology that came to him in a moment of inspiration as he recovered from that crisis of ill health. So his theology of salvation is a product of trauma. It's a product of his fears during the English Civil War about what had caused it. And if the cause is the antinomian. So what he's trying to do, right, is in that book is just stop us from heading into antinomianism. That's what he's trying to do. Now, Owen also is a Calvinist, but he has the opposite fear. He's worried about the Arminians. So everything that he's trying to do is to stop us going in the direction of the Arminians. Baxter sounds worryingly like an Arminian. He is heading in the direction of the Arminians. He is giving encouragement to the Arminians. Not only that, in the 1650s, Owen's big haunting fear is not so much the Arminians, but the Socinians, right, who are anti-Trinitarian, who uses language of scripture sufficiency and mere Christianity to say we should just believe the scriptures. And this Trinitarian thing, that's not in scripture, not if you read it flatly and literally. That's just a human innovation that came later, right? Well, the incredible thing is that Baxter himself uses the language of mere Christianity and scripture sufficiency. He sounds like a Socinian. Just when Owen needed strong allies to defend Orthodox Christianity, not even Calvinist Christianity, but Orthodox Christianity, here's Baxter sounding exactly like a Socinian. So I'm finally going to answer your question, right? Baxter is a Calvinist, but he's not a reliable Calvinist. But the tradition after his death, it picks up on those seeds and actually takes us off into Unitarianism. So when Brian in the mid-18th century, you know, adds Baxterianism to his list, that's probably why, right? As the Unitarians, those who are not Trinitarian, they can look for their heritage back to Baxter, right? So Baxter would be horrified by that. Of course he was Trinitarian. Of course he was Calvinist. But he's got these fears. And that's the interesting thing about Baxter and Owen. They're both worried about the opposite thing and worried that each other is just giving aid to the enemy. They both think that. So Baxter sees Owen as helping the antinomians, and Owen sees Baxter as helping the Arminians. So they've got a lot of common ground. They're both Calvinists, but boy, they seem to be heading in different directions, and that's deeply worrying for both of them.
Yes, yes. That's really helpful to hear some of that other background. I do want to talk about Baxter's doctrine of justification, especially when you look at someone like John Owen. How close were they? Was it semantics? Was there material differences? You'd mentioned about, you know, evangelical righteousness versus legal righteousness. Mm-hmm. For Baxter, was he trying to find a middle between Arminianism and Calvinism with that? Was it a doctrine of justification that ultimately denies, well, I guess, does he deny the imputation of Christ's act of obedience? Does that follow from his evangelical righteousness requirement?
He's got no problem with the imputation of Christ's righteousness within the category of legal righteousness. Gotcha. It's just that there's additional righteousness that we need to bring. Let me bring in another difference between the two. Owen went to university, stayed at university, did a master's at university. Became in the 1650s the vice chancellor of Oxford University and a doctor of divinity, right? So Owen is steeped in the university. Baxter, highly unusual for a minister not to go to university. He did not go to university. So Owen is, you know, a disciplined, trained theologian. Baxter is self-taught and highly idiosyncratic in terms of how his theology is formed in the pressure cooker of the Civil War. So Baxter's theology is suspect, and Owen's is much more orthodox in its structure and its Baxter's not unorthodox. That's not what I mean. But Owen is a theologian's theologian, right? So That's basically the difference between the two. But Garrett, having laid that foundation, I'm now trying to remember what I'm supposed to be answering. So can you remind me, where am I going with this?
I was asking about how his doctrine of justification, like, is it like really close to how the Reformed tradition would want to say it, or is it mm-hmm. is it just something really different? Mm.
It's quite different. Yeah, it's quite different. So thank you. That's the point I was making, is that like, let's just forget about Baxter's soteriology. Let's not try to preserve it. It was, you know, a highly idiosyncratic, highly schematic, you know, well thought out, highly intelligent, well read, all of that, but not a goer. There's, you know, I think John Wesley in the 18th century published an abridgment of the aphorisms, but that's about it. And it was an abridgment. It's like you took the bits that you needed. Let's just quietly ignore Baxter's theology of salvation. I think that's a major reason why he's not so popular within Reformed circles. I think there are some, I'm going to say he's a Calvinist. But there are good reasons why a Calvinist would view Baxter with some suspicion, and as being unhelpful and unreliable. But you know, it's not heresy. I don't think he's a heretic. It's just the way he constructed things. Didn't really find a following.
That's often how I talk about Baxter. Is he has some really great qualities, especially in his practical theology. I know I just saw recently, maybe Reformation Heritage just has a new edition of Baxter's Practical Theology. So maybe we can talk more about some of those great things about Baxter, like his Christian Directory. What exactly was he trying to accomplish in the Christian Directory? It's huge.
Yeah. Christian Directory, about 1,000,000 words. You know, it's one volume in that 4-volume set. It's amazing. So Christian Directory was published in 1672 or 3. It's in that period where Baxter is not a pastor, so he's turning his mind to being a pastor through his books. A Christian Directory answers every conceivable case of conscience that you could think of. It's divided into 4 parts. It looks at government, it looks at church, it looks at private life. It's just the whole sweep of practical Christianity. It's like any question that you want to ask a pastor, well, here's the answer to it. Right down to my favorite that sticks in my mind is the question of whether you're allowed to divorce a spouse who's tried to murder you. So it's just, you know, it's fantastic. So that's what's going on in that book. This is Baxter's pastoral guidance for living. Of course, every book in many ways was like that. But interesting that Baxter's works were published, only the practical works, that's what they're called, right? So the polemical works, you know, let's just put those over there. Let's never republish the aphorisms of justification. But his practical works, I mean, they're amazing. They can be critiqued, certainly, but boy, his heart for the Christian faith, you can't repress it. It's definitely highly Puritan, but also in a distinctive Baxterian way, if I use that language.
Well, that's great. Yeah. You know, we talked about the Reformed pastor just briefly. We mentioned it. I remember reading the Reformed pastor. I found the first half so inspiring and insightful. The latter half really was a struggle. I was wondering if you could just comment on, I think it may have been Carl Truman that said something like, this is the kind of pastoral theology that like a sociopath would write. Or something like that. Is the Reformed pastor a good model?
Oh, that's great. Another good question, Garrett. And look, I'm just going to commend you for reading, you know, getting through the half of it and finding it okay. I mean, for the average person, I think the book is unreadable and inaccessible. So I recently published a modernized radical abridgment of that book. It's 20% of the original size. What Carl's putting his finger on is that Baxter sets a very, very, very high bar, a very high bar. And you're likely to read that book and feel inadequate. This is a book for the heroic. And Baxter was heroic, and that's the standard he sets for everyone else. By requiring pastors to meet on a regular basis, by which he means in his case with a large parish once a year, with all the willing families to just see how they're getting on and test their faith, right? And it took 2 days a week, all day, all evening, 2 days for him and his assistant, who's also doing it. Very high bar. Baxter sets a high bar, whatever book he's writing. Here's my take on that is, again, it comes back to the Civil War, which confronted him on a daily basis with death and eternity. And in Baxter's calculus, there's a remarkable privileging of eternity, distinctive. I mean, Christians do talk about eternity, but for him, it was a governing mechanism. So in any moment of the day, I have a choice about what I should do, and it's not enough just to do the good thing. I need to do the best thing, and the best thing is in view of eternity. So if you're thinking about pastoral ministry and eternity, here are souls within your care who are heading either to heaven or to hell, right? And you're their pastor. It's a parish. It's a mixed bag. You've got all sorts. Everyone in the town is a part of the parish. So it's a very, very high bar, and that's difficult to read, and I think it's really important to hear that, to hear his voice, because it's not a voice that we hear in our culture. I don't see many voices in our culture setting a high bar. That's just not the culture we're in or the moment we're in. So to get his voice from the past, that's helpful, just to feed in and to be aware of that voice, but not to be daunted by it, not to be discouraged by it. But to just add it into the mix and be faithful in our terms to the ministry that God's given us to do. And if we do that with the book, I think it's really helpful. It's a fascinating book. It's great.
So I've got a somewhat general question just on how we should think about figures from the past who are a mixed bag. I mean, I know everybody's a mixed bag to some extent, but how do we treat people who, let's, like we said, we don't want to retrieve or keep any of his soteriology. Let's kind of ignore that. Is that like, do we want to tell people in our church, go read some Baxter? Or do we want to tell aspiring ministers, go read some Baxter, even if there are these areas? I mean, how should we think about that with people that we have significant disagreements with at times?
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. I think we're safe to read Baxter, right? Let me just say that. Read Baxter. Baxter's good for us. If we're going to read a book like The Aphorisms of Justification or one of his more polemical works, by polemical I mean attacking others' figures or their beliefs, if we're going to read those books, well, we need to be a bit forearmed with a bit of wisdom and context and a framing to receive those books and understand them as a product of their time and place. But I think we should read Baxter for that voice. And it's, in some ways, it's that Puritan voice. But Baxter is a Puritan's Puritan. And that's the voice we're going to get. Not just a very staunch high bar, but the staunchest, highest bar you can possibly get. But that's good for us. And he just thinks in different ways because he comes from a different era. And when we encounter that different thinking, we don't need to just accept it, but it might prompt us to reevaluate our own time, our own thinking, what we're hearing on the radio, in that book, from the pulpit, whatever. I think he's just another voice. I mean, this is the value of history, to bring in a sense of perspective from different voices in the past. And to have a relatively high view of the church is not just the congregation I happen to be part of right at the moment, but the church existing across the world and across the centuries. And there is a lot of wisdom in the past. We have a view on this side of the Enlightenment, if I can use that language, that the best is in the future. That's a very unusual view. For the most of history, we've felt that the best is in the past. The past is not irrelevant. The past is not dead. The past can speak very profitably to us. And I think Baxter's a good voice to be listening to, and so is Owen. You know, we should read them. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's really great. And you know, we can learn by way of imitation, and we can learn by way of contrast. And we should have some discernment to know the difference there. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask mm-hmm. about Baxter's political theology a bit. You mentioned he's mm-hmm. a nonconformist, and I'm curious: mm-hmm. was his nonconformity because of issues with the Book of Common Prayer or the 39 Articles or with the establishment in general? What was motivating his nonconformity?
Good. If you know anything about the Puritans, they had conscience was very important. Conscience was very, very important. And there was a precision in the way that they understood the faith that was highly, highly important to them. When the Church of England was re-established in 1660, very quickly the politics of the situation shifted away from the likes of Baxter and towards the restored bishops of the Church of England, who wanted to bring back what we now call Anglicanism, based around the prayer book, which set a liturgy for the church services in the Church of England. And in a move that was deliberately designed to exclude and take revenge on the Puritans for what they had engineered during the Civil War and after, the restored bishops set a test for anyone going into ministry. They had to take an oath that everything in the Book of Common Prayer was right and acceptable. And they had to disavow something called the Solemn League and Covenant, which was an oath that had been sworn early in the Civil War from about 1643 onwards. Now, you know, an oath is an oath. You can't disavow an oath for Baxter, nor can you possibly say that this book, written in human language, is somehow perfect in its expression. You can't in good conscience do that. And therefore, because you can't make that claim for yourself, you can't be a minister in the Church of England. So it came down to matters of conscience. Baxter's got no problem with the Church of England. He loves the Church of England. He wants the Church of England to bring in a broad array of Christians, not a narrow one. But he found him and his fellow Puritans excluded, and that's why he's a nonconformist.
So I'd be interested also to hear a little bit about his general advice for dealing with things like grief and suffering and death.
Yep.
Because I know you have the abridged volume of his Saints' Everlasting Rest.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And given how you've explained his experience of the Civil War, that seems like something that's probably on his mind quite a bit. So I'd love to hear just his general advice for that.
Yeah. This is one of the pastoral issues, just one of the pastoral issues that he's good at dealing with in terms of grief. One of the classic ways of expressing this is through a funeral sermon. So often these sermons would be published. So someone big and important dies, or their wife dies. Often Baxter's preaching at the death of women, and will in those sermons. Here's the Puritan way, here's the Baxterian way. Make some good out of the event for the edification of those around them. So Baxter, for a start, is very aware of grief. He saw a lot of death during the Civil War. He doesn't mention their names, but, you know, friends dying during the war. He's confronted by death. But remember his calculus is to do with eternity, right? So when you place eternity over death, that reframes it quite profoundly. So Baxter would not, how shall I say this, encourage a sort of indulgence in our grief. He would want to recognize it and work with it and do justice to it. But also recognize the theological truth that this person who has died is not dead. Is just departed from us, and we'll join them at some point in heaven. So it's his framing on that. This came home to him when his wife died. So he married in 1663. He married Margaret Charlton, who was, I think, 23 years younger than him. And she died before him. She died in 1681. And he wrote a book. He wrote a book of her private papers that he found. He published them, and he, with an introduction to her, that he wrote, as he says, under the power of melting grief. Lovely phrase. So I want to say that Baxter is both sensitive and pastoral about grief, but he'd also want to call us to a higher view that in the scheme of eternity, death is not death, or death is not the end. And he'd want to remind us of that.
Yeah, that's great. That really is beautiful. I wanted to ask if how Baxter evolved over his life of ministry. You know, Augustine, at the end of his life, wrote a volume called Retractions, where it's basically, here's some things that I wrote long ago, and I would say it differently now, or I've changed my mind about. You know, Baxter wrote so much and lived in such a volatile period. Are there things that, you know, if you read early Baxter, you're really not getting the true Baxter, or like at least not final Baxter. Are there any issues like that with him?
Listen, Baxter, among all, it's hard to believe there was a book that Baxter didn't write, but he would never write a book called Retractions. He was not good at retractions. He's so lovely to watch operate. Even when it looks like he's apologizing for something, he's not. He's criticizing his enemies. It's just the deft way he does that without you even recognizing it until you really pay attention. He does not do retractions. That's not him. But where there are shifts, though, there can be shifts in emphasis. So he was deeply traumatized in the 1640s, but his Kidderminster experience brought him into a settled world. And as the 1650s went on, he became more confident and optimistic and more Calvinist. So if you read his books, the sort of layering of the hedges begin to disappear, and he speaks in much more clearly Calvinist terms, because he's not so worried about the antinomians. Until he is. They come back later on in his fears. And then you come to 1660. Listen, that was a grievous disappointment. In his own words, that was a wound that would never be healed in this world, and it never did heal. All his optimism, he was at the height of his optimism in 1659, then it all collapsed. And I won't tell you this story, but you can guess who he blamed for engineering that collapse? John Owen. Wait for the book, read about that. But there's that. He goes through these movements, big seasons, big shifts in his context, and they change the way he writes. But look, he's not one essentially to change his view. He was, and he admitted that that he just doesn't do that. Once he's thought something through to his own satisfaction, that's it. You can't budge him. I can't budge him. He can't budge himself. He's a fixed entity within those bounds, because no human is fixed. We change. Of course we do. That's the really interesting thing. Even Owen changes. And if Owen is taken to be a theologian of this rarefied system who doesn't change, he changes. Crawford Gribbin's work on that is really good. He identifies the changes, and sometimes they're quite remarkable.
That's great. I don't know the answer to this. I'm assuming Baxter probably preached extemporaneously, or did he preach from notes?
No, he could preach extemporaneously, but he preached from notes, and they became his books often.
Gotcha.
So many of his practical works began their life as a sermon series.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I was just wondering how many of his sermons survived as in its sermonic form, or if it was more.
Yep. Occasionally he published them, and it's clearly a sermon. He preached it. It was published. Other times, like I think, is it A Call to the Unconverted? I can't remember exactly, but that book in the 1650s, that's one that would have been a sermon series. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yep. Wonderful. Well, we want to commend your work. I know just with Crossway, you've got an edition of the Saints Everlasting Rest that's revised and made accessible, as well as the Reformed Pastor. Your new book is called When Christians Disagree, Lessons from the Fractured Relationship of John Owen and Richard Baxter. It's coming out this summer, 2024. We just want to encourage our listeners to go ahead and get that book. You can pre-order it now if you listen when the podcast releases. If you listen after the summer, you can just go ahead and order it. I'm excited about that volume. I'm really looking forward to reading that. Are you doing any other work on Baxter? Any projects forthcoming that you can talk about?
I've got a big research project, which is an edition of his correspondence. So in addition to all those published works, he left behind over 1,200 letters, either to or from him. So I'm editing a volume of letters that he wrote or received in 1659 and 60. That's going to be published by Oxford University Press. But we're back to one of those very scholarly, very expensive books. So don't expect a layperson's abridgment of that one. So I'm that's a huge, huge project, multi-year project, and I'm making good progress, but I'm a fair way from the end. So I'm trying to do, you know, scholarly research for an academic audience as a historian, but I'm also trying to bring Baxter out to a wider audience. I feel like I owe him that. He's been really good to me. And I'm just so pleased. I'm so delighted that Crossway took on these works and that nearly 400 years on, Baxter is still being published. I just think that's great. It might be a modernized, abridged version, but it's still his voice and his works, and kudos to Crossway for backing that.
Well, that is wonderful. There's a whole bunch of other rabbit trails I would love to chase, but I think this has just been just a delightful interview. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Do you have a website, or are you on social media? Is there a place people can go to keep track of your work?
Basically, Baxter and I have this in common, that neither of us is on social media. I am not one of those authors that just puts myself out there. I think I've got an author page on Amazon. I'm sorry, I'm hard to find, but I hope the books are easy to find. Yeah.
Well, this has been a ton of fun, Tim. We appreciate you taking the time to do this episode with us. I think everybody will enjoy it. Those of you who are listening, I know that you did enjoy it, so I'll make sure to put the links to the books in the show notes so you can click them, be on the lookout for the new book from Crossway, as well as just keep updated with what Tim's doing. Try to find up on his work. Clearly, he's doing some really interesting and good work. So, Tim, thanks for all that you do and for the spirit that you do it in. We commend that to our listeners. And for everybody who's been tuning in, we thank you for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.